everyone. This is Lynn Harder, co-producer and host of Defining Moments podcast. I'm delighted you've tuned in for today's episode. We're joined by Dr. Shelley Rollins. Shelley is an assistant professor of communication at Utah Tech University. Her research explores public and private relational contexts of fellowship and estrangement. She also explores how people pursue freedom and agency together through activism, allyship, and leadership. At the heart of this episode is an article by Shelley in Health Communication titled, "It Was Something That Is a Necessity: Stories of Collective Protest, Vulnerability, and Well-Being." This is a timely and important essay that reflects on matters of vulnerability, vicarious trauma, and physical and emotional burnout among activists. Shelley, thank you for your work that invites us all to consider the risks and the sacrifices involved in caring and advocating with and for others. And thank you for joining us today, Shelley.
Great. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with an invitation for you. You live an activist life and you study how people experience collective protest. What moves you to explore protest participation?
Sure. Great question. Well, you know, I've always been interested in politics and, you know, kind of the institutional and, you know, interpersonal kind of back and forth. And I think a lot of times, you know, hegemonic institutional powers, as we're especially seeing now, can just completely target and oppress whole groups of people. And when that happens, something needs to respond to that. And what really moves me about protest and collective protest is a couple things. First of all, it's people that are like-minded to you that are concerned about something. And typically it's not you're concerned about yourself. You are concerned about yourself because for me, it's a very ethical engagement with my concern for other people's well-being, you know, and that affects my own well-being because it's a very relational experience. And the first time I got really interested in it was I went to the first Women's March in 2017 on Washington, D.C., and it was incredible to me and actually life-changing to be with, you know, 3 million other people that of all different walks of life, all different ages, demographics. It was peaceful, but it was spirited, and it gave me this kind of catharsis of feeling like it's going to be okay, that I'm not as alone as I felt before, and that stuck with me, and that was really something that drew me to it. And then I decided to do my dissertation about collective protest.
I really appreciate your relational orientation, where it's clear that our sense of self is always already in tandem with others. And for those who engage in protest, it seems like, based on your work, that they typically locate themselves in their life worlds in ways that enable everybody to recognize that others' possibilities and challenges are intimately connected to our own experiences, our own privilege, our own disadvantage, right? And when you join with others, in your words, it's comforting to know that you don't feel as alone. You're not as alone.
Yes, and I'd add to that another thing that I'm very interested interested in and that's central to my work is the idea of strangerdom or just being a stranger. And I think that thinking about the stranger, I have an article actually called Living Stories on Others' Doorsteps. And it's about doing some activist work that I did in Maine for a social kind of grassroots social welfare program where I would go door to door all over Maine and very kind of remote pockets of Maine and register people to vote and tell them about some important social issues that are affecting their lives. And doing that, you know, I met all kinds of people. Some of them were scary. Some of them were wonderful. Some of them were like, couldn't care less. And it ran the whole gamut of possibilities. But what I realized is when I'm knocking on their door and they open it and they look at me like, who are you? You know, and I'm looking at them like, are you going to be cool with this? And I just sort of realized that this constitution of strangerdom, sometimes we forget because we're so inside ourselves, that when we're looking at someone else as a stranger, we're also a stranger to them. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of talked about in that article that it's important for each of us to kind of give a little, you know, to connect. So, you know, that carries a little bit into protest in this really beautiful way as well, that it's a huge collective of mostly strangers, but there is this electricity in the air and this, you know, group connection. The whole thing is a mystery. When you're heading to a protest, you don't know how it's going to go, who's going to be there, if there's going to be counter protests, if there's going to be danger, you know, if it's going to be fun or if it's, and that's the whole thing. I don't think that people go to protest for fun pictures, you know, that they can post. I think it's like a calling that they respond to with their whole body, you know, and, mm-hmm. and seeing other people do that, I think it's fascinating and really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And demands that you stay settled and present, even in the discomfort of what you call strangerdom. Right. And,
yes.
and trying to cultivate that sense of common ground.
Yes. Well said.
It also reminds me that I think hope and despair are not disconnected, that there is this vibrant interplay between them. Hope, mm-hmm. hope lives really close to a sense of despair. There's so much in the world right now, and I think across time, that can evoke reasonable despair. And yet, when you have strangers and like-minded people coming together, hope is ever present amidst those wise advocates in a sense of there's a desire to shift the world on its axis, that hope is an orientation to the world, that things can be more equitable, things can be better.
Yeah. That's a really interesting point. I like that kind of idea of a dialectic of hope and despair, because you don't necessarily need hope unless you have some sort of level of discomfort, you know, concern, despair, you know, and you don't necessarily have despair unless you're lacking, you know, hope. And I'm feeling, you know, pretty, getting a little bit too comfortable, feeling rather hopeless at this person, you know, at this specific time. But what is encouraging to me is, you know, for example, seeing the No Kings protest, that like, if you just give the people a place to go, they want to go. But that's, I think, one of the greatest challenges of protest movements and social movements is, how do you continue to get people to come out and have them feel that they've achieved something? Because, you know, sometimes it can make things feel more, you might feel more in despair once you can realize how large the problem is or how. But, you know, at the same time, seeing other people identify that this is a big deal. I really like how you put those two together. That's a great call.
Mm. And thinking about hope as a verb, thinking about it as an action, if we're less tied to a specific outcome, right, what we're hoping for, we can think about hope more as a muscle of sorts that we have to exercise and engage, always moving toward, why does it have to be this way? What if? Knowing that even today's solutions can be tomorrow's problems. From this perspective, hope isn't that rose-colored glasses, everything is great. It is more an orientation to the world that demands our presence. And
Yeah, it's a relationship to the present and an eye to the future, you know, with also lessons from the past, you know, like everything. And I think one of the most curious aspects of protest is, you know, it's a public event. It's a public performance. It's a collective performance. But some of its strength comes from its mercurity, right? Like, it's very mercurial. You don't know who's going to be there. You don't know what's going to happen, and you don't know how it's going to be covered. So, you know, a lot of times, depending on what your political position is, it's very vulnerable to being cast negatively, right? Like at the LA Kings, at the No Kings LA protest, you know, it was a huge turnout. And I think, you know, maybe one police car was lit on fire, but they just seize on that image to try to characterize the entire thing, you know, in that way.
Yeah.
And so it's very vulnerable to that. And it makes me think a little bit about my master's advisor Dr. Kristen Langelier, and Eric Peterson wrote a really famous piece called The Double Binds, where they talk about, you know, how performance is both aesthetic and epistemic, and that there's like, you know, they call it like a Mobius strip, right? It's kind of always bound up in both, but depending on which moments you seize upon, it can appear more as an aesthetic thing or more of an epistemic thing. Yeah, which I think is also why storytelling is so important for people to share their experiences about being there, because a lot of the articles that are written about protest events are from people that were not there. And I find too often they allied voices of protesters who were there and sort of just what it looks like, you know, from a macro perspective rather than the intimacy that takes place there.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important when we're witnessing stories of others or about events that we're mindful of whose interests are best being served by the stories that are told, and to mindfully reflect on choices that are made by those storytellers. So to stay in the same place for a second, LA, over the course of the past few months, there have been lots of different protests. I was really stuck in thinking about how various 24/7 news stations were covering what was unfolding. And there were both similarities and there were differences in that. So, for example, at one point in time, you could turn on the TV and going across the ticker tape at the bottom, in the lower thirds, you would see a title, Protests Over ICE Raids in LA. And you flip two channels and the lower thirds read something very different. They read Dems side with deranged activists, followed by 6 days of riots and lawlessness. And those are distinctly different ways of framing these characters who are connected with each other, who are organizing in time and place. And for some of the commentators, the presence of the military and active troops represents safety. And for others, that those same images and individuals represent civic breakdown. And across all of it, irrespective of what you're talking about, you see the lone image of the car on fire. And it's hard not to pay attention to that, irrespective of what people are saying. So trying to negotiate these somewhat distinct worlds where there's very little overlap in terms of how people are framing and narrating the world, with a knowledge that how you narrate has consequences.
Yeah, there's a lot of, it feels like that there was a lot, like that California and LA especially was going to become the example that is made, you know, out of this, out of this administration, that, you know, for example, Trump asked his, you know, one of his assistants in his first presidency, why don't you just shoot the protesters in the legs? That'll make them go away. It's very dark. It's very profound. But when we think about, there's a mystery to crowds, you know, like if you go to a concert and it's a band that you love, you feel really good there. Maybe if you go to a concert and it's not your type of music, you don't have that same feeling. And it's a similar feeling to going to a sports event, you know, maybe a home game of a team that you love, and you're with all these people. It feels safe. It feels good. It feels different, you know, when there are like counter protesters, or, you know, in this case, you know, increasingly there's more like masked and militarized types of responses that are threatening the First Amendment right to be there. And so they are breaking the law, but they're also in charge of the law. So that's very troubling to me. But what this also kind of reminds me is this, the original theory of crowd behavior is Le Bon's. He's a French conservative anti-protester theorist, but he came up with contagion theory, which is also known as the mob mentality. And what that tries to do is to cast crowds as irresponsible, dangerous. He calls them savage and like members of the lower form of humanity, like women and children. So you can kind of get a sense of how cool he is. But it also, you know, he had a larger concern. He was very anti-French Revolution. And when he saw, you know, crowds trying to reclaim and citizens trying to reclaim their rights and the ability to live well and live happy, successful, productive lives, he only saw them kind of destroying important artwork or like harming buildings. But the thing is that these buildings are for the people to begin with, you know, and I don't sponsor destruction, but that's, again, just another example of sort of taking, you know, what's the worst possible scenario and trying to centralize it as if that was the goal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this is why things are so vulnerable. But also the idea that these people, it takes away the agency, right? People, I don't know about you, but I've never just seen like this wild crowd and just been like, I'm going to get in that. It's not real, but it still stands, right? Like what you were saying, you know, these deranged rioters, you know, this mob, there's more to it than that. There's very intentional decisions being made there. There are risks being taken. Mm-hmm. It's not fun. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, I think that's the thing. They think that these are people just having fun or like seizing upon an opportunity, you know, for whatever. No, like, this is hard to get there. You have to park, you know, it's like hot, you need sunscreen, you got to make some signs. You have no clue what's going to happen. And especially in this really vitriolic, you know, political scene right now, you never know if people are going to show up with guns. Like there was, I don't know if I should go, there was this incident at a No Kings rally in Salt Lake City. I live in Southern Utah. And so I guess there was a person there with a gun that was a peace officer. So the person there with a gun, they see someone else holding like an AK-47 machine gun. And they're like, uh-oh, I better get that. So they shoot at that person with the machine gun and accidentally kill someone who was completely uninvolved next to them. And so, you know, this is another thing I'm very interested in is the complications between the First and Second Amendment. You know, the more lax our gun laws become, the less safe our First Amendment and the right to protest becomes, because they can't coexist in that space, in my opinion.
This connects to, I think, a really poignant argument that you make that is articulated in the article that's at the heart of today's episode published in Health Communication. You argue that protest work is always already embodied, that we protest with our bodies in relation to other body selves. Sometimes we bear the trauma of our ancestors, and sometimes our bodies are put in harm's way. Can you talk to us about how collective protesting lives through its demands on the body?
Yeah. You know, I mean, depending on how able you are, you know, do you have a car? Are you able-bodied? You know, it's like, so for me, just to touch on this for a second, the Women's March in 2017 was incredible. I saw like four generations, you know, of a family, like with like a granddaughter pushing a great grandmother in a wheelchair. I think that that's not as easy for you to get here, you know, as it was for me. But I also traveled from Southern Illinois, you know, met my brother who came from North Carolina and my other friend who came from Connecticut, you know, and we just had to like navigate this together. It was hard to get on the train. Like my brother's arm almost didn't get in, you know, into the door because there's like a baby carriage there with a baby in it. And so, you know, of course, first and foremost, it is embodied and it is labor. It's emotional and physical labor, as you mentioned earlier. But at the same time, it's taking a risk, you know, it's anxious business for me. The protests I've been to, I'm like, I hope nothing bad happens, you know, and that almost for like a second kind of makes me not want to go. But that's part of it. And so it's a collective risk that is assumed, you know, and it's also a collective benefit. It's collective hope and collective despair, as you were as you aptly put earlier. So, you know, and but it also, as I mentioned, after I went to that protest, I carried that with me in my body. It created this hearth, you know, of humanity within me. And when things were kind of hard and I was feeling a little bit more estranged and maybe alone, I could think back to it and it would just fill me with like the strength that I needed. And I still think that way about it.
I find profound your way of framing this work as anxious business. And that anxiousness is felt in our bodies. It lands on who we are. It can block airways. It can strain our muscles. It can unsettle us in the marrow of our bones and can lead to trauma, which is a response to what's going on in events. It's an embodied response. So all of those emotions that we feel, fear and hope and even relaxation, we feel that in our bodies, and that's serious.
Yeah, it really is. You know, it's kind of like the, you know, that dialectic of, you know, expectation and unpredictability. As people, we really like to have a good sense of how our day is going to go, right? Like the older we get, I feel like the better we get at our routines, and just because things are more comfortable for us if we know what to expect. You know, as if we're in a new place or we move to a new area, we have that anxiety, you know, before we know everyone and, you know people well enough and have them know us, you know? So I think that it really is kind of the anxious business is that not knowing how it's going to happen and, you know, hoping for the best, but it is a risk. Like I'm tired of, you know, the depictions of protest as if it's just for a picture, you know, just to put a picture on social media that you were there. Like, how can you reduce it to that? Mm-hmm. You are there and you're sharing it even more broadly by sharing a picture of you being there. It's not an individual, you know, narcissistic exercise in any way, in my mind.
Hi, folks. This is Lynn breaking in for just a second. We've been talking to Shelley Rollins about the vulnerability, trauma, and physical and emotional burnout among activists. For your convenience, we've placed links to her recently published article in Health Communication in our show notes and on our social media. Okay, back to the conversation. In your article, you elevate the stories of two people who've been part of your research over the past few years. One of them is named Kay in your article, and one of them is named Catherine. And both of them kind of reveal this anxious business and the embodied nature of risk and vulnerability in protest work. If you're willing to do so, Shelley, could you read for listeners Kay's story for us?
Sure. So this is called It Felt Like It Was Something That Is a Necessity. I think I needed somebody to hear that I was angry, which I was. And then I think it was also the fact that, and I pride myself on this, I don't march only for the things that I care about. So if you're not going to answer me and you're not going to listen to what I have to say as an individual, then I'm going to join this mass of people and you're going to have to answer us as a group. So it wasn't necessarily feeling like I needed something to do as much as I felt like it was something that is a necessity. And it was a right that my ancestors, whether they were women or black women, fought to be able to do and died. Why would I take that for granted? This is my right as an American citizen to, you know, get together with this other group of people that feel exactly the same way that I do.
From the beginning of that story where Kay shares she needed someone to hear, there's this desire for answerability, right? To be seen, to be heard.
Yes. Yes. I thought that she did a really nice job in several places. I just included this one in this article. But Kay did a really wonderful job of vocalizing kind of her individual dissatisfaction, the importance of finding community that also feels dissatisfied, and how that sort of ameliorates some of that anger. And what was kind of unique about her across my participants is that she was one of those people that's active in like every cause that she possibly can be. So like, you know, March for Science, March for Our Lives, the women's marches, the immigration marches. Some people feel kind of pressured to stick to kind of one sort of activist cause, but she was unique that she went to all of them. And so she kind of had this really fascinating perspective. Elsewhere, she talked about, because she went to the women's march too, and I saw her there actually, because she's a friend of my brother's in North Carolina. But she talked about how when she was marching, she looked up, you know, past skyscrapers, she looked up and saw people holding up encouraging messages to them in government buildings written on toilet paper. And she's like, oh my God, they see me. She's like, but also I see them and they're part of this too. And so we were like waving to them, letting them know that we saw them, you know, and she's like, it was just this electric feeling of connection with them. And yeah, it's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For her, she especially is driven when she's angry. Like that's her activating mode for her. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so she has to live in a certain, in an aspect of being where clearly if she's going to all these things, she's really mad, you know, about all types of things. Right. But for her to sustain that, you know, it's hard to hold anger, right? It's hard to keep encountering it. Right. But for her, it's what inspires her to attend, mm-hmm. you know, and she keeps doing it, which I find so admirable. And she still does.
It's a mobilizing emotion. And it's one that when it is acknowledged, even if it's on toilet paper, right, that's in the window of a skyscraper, right, that answerability to another, right, to their experience of the human condition, it's a powerful aspect of what it means to be human, that's what we seek, right, to be seen and heard in all of our complexities and our anger and our hope.
Yeah. And I think, you know, anger is part of despair, right? Like, you know, the words for emotions are never able to fully encapture, you know, the complexity, the relational levels and complexities that, you know, it's wonderful to have somewhere to go though, where, you know, it's a safe place where you know that other people are feeling similar to you. Cause it feels very estranging to be angry alone, you know? Like there's no way out of that. How do you work that out for yourself? I'm a firm believer that, you know, we need relationships with friends and loved ones and strangers to keep us in this, you know, healthy, productive humanity. And it gets difficult and challenging when, you know, the institutions and the powers that be and the hegemonic forces are exerting force on us that we don't have contact with that, right? We just kind of receive it, I guess, through tweets, right? Or news articles. And so putting life to it and putting embodiment, I think there's just so many important aspects of protests that I truly feel like are missed often in media coverage that, again, doesn't speak with the people that were there.
Right. We live in a culture that almost valorizes unfettered individualism. And that's reflected in our healthcare system, where we think about disease as something that's experienced by an individual. And certainly a tumor at the end of a femur is diagnosed in a body. And yet that is never experienced in isolation from a family, from socio-material circumstances in which a person lives. And so if we can move toward an understanding that trauma is always already collective, then healing must be too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Kay, such a deep person. But when she also talks about in that story I shared, that when she's there, she's not just there like her today, her by herself. She's thinking about this whole historical experience of her ancestors. You know, as a Black woman in the South, in the United States, she experiences, you know, that double oppression and that double bind of, you know, am I being judged because I'm a woman? Am I being judged because I'm Black, or am I being targeted because I'm a Black woman? You know, mm-hmm, and also, you know, there's this negative racist trope of like the angry Black woman. And I think that she is just leaning into that and owning that, and also knowing that it's okay to feel that way when there's injustice. And her thinking about, you know, that her ancestors were slaves here. You know, how did she get here other than that? Well, I mean, there's other ways to get here, but she's pretty familiar with her, yeah, with her ancestry. Yeah. So she even feels like a responsibility on top of her own discomfort, her own present discomfort, her own concerns, you know, that like, that she owes it to her ancestors that didn't have this opportunity. And so why would she waste that? Why wouldn't she be there? Like, she has the freedom to feel angry. She has the freedom to choose to go there. And also, you know, as a woman of color, if, you know, going to like Black Lives Matter protests, I often am concerned, you know, or I just feel like really strong empathy for that can also heighten, you know, that wow, you know, maybe things haven't changed that much if we're still doing this. And it just, I think it's very courageous to lean into that and to exercise, you know, her freedom and her agency and her choice. And for her to be able to hold all of that, you know, and balance all of that in her body, I think is so courageous and inspiring. You know, that's something that I don't have access to in my body, but by listening to her, you know, now that's part of me, you know, and I think that's something that we really need to hear, you know, that, it, you know, if we talk about the LA protests, immigration protests, LA has the most number of immigrants, you know, of any city in the US, and it has a history of protesting, you know, anti-immigration types of things. The current mayor of LA, Karen Bass, was an activist from the 80s, late 80s and early 90s, when they were trying to kind of get rid of birthright citizenship. And there was such a strong response that they kind of dropped it. So it's interesting to see, you know, kind of the same thing happening again. But also in LA, since it is such a diverse and it's a very healthy, you know, there's all kinds of communities. And there's a lot of immigrants there, and there's immigrants that have been there, you know, for 40 years, for 30 years, for 20 years. And they are, you know, with these tactics, these militarized tactics of SWAT gear against peaceful protesters. It's like they're trying to invite some sort of trigger that's mm-hmm. going to make the protesters look bad. But, you know, at the same time, it's a lot of times the people that were on the street were there protesting for their grandparents, mm-hmm, right? Were there for their uncles and their cousins, and you know, but also they look, right, like immigrants, so they're putting themselves in danger, it's hard to see.
Yeah, protesters carry their histories with them in their bodies to the places where they join with others who they hope are like-minded. And that is certainly reflected in Kay's words. It's also present in the story of Catherine, another person who is featured in your article. Can you share, for readers who have yet to read your article, can you share Catherine's story?
Sure. I'll just give just a little background. So Catherine, this is called I Was Scared at the Time. Catherine's involved in an organization called Heartwood, which is kind of a Midwestern, Illinois, Ohio, Indiana, based eco-activist group that she actually grew up with. Her mom started taking her to Heartwood when she was a baby. And so she's been a member her entire life. So here is her story. I was scared at the time. So there's no wood, and they're in the prairie in the middle of winter at Standing Rock. The cops had this place at a distance off the reservation, pretty much surrounded. You couldn't get in. And myself, along with several other people from Heartwood, from around Indiana, Illinois, took truckloads of wood up there and had to sneak in and like go around through weird little dirt roads that weren't around these police barricades that like with the headlights off in the middle of the prairie, in the middle of the night, trying to get wood to these people so they could fucking eat and stay warm. I felt like a secret agent. It was really exciting, but it was also terrifying. And a lot of people were doing that, you know? We were not by any means the only people doing that. We couldn't possibly be the only people doing that. They would be dying out there. I was not unlikely to take that risk ever. It was not something that scared me. What scared me was being in the situation. I wasn't scared of doing it. I was scared at the time because holy shit, if they catch us, it's really going to fucking suck. And especially because I've got like 6 people in the truck with me. And 2 of them said, if cops come at us, I'm shooting them. And I'm like, no, no, no. We are not going that far.
Anxious business.
Yes. Yeah. And so like, this really speaks to, I think, the unpredictability, you know, that we've been talking about, that she had no idea that there were guns, that she was with people that had guns, you know, that was their last resort, or that would be their, you know, if it goes like this, then this is going to happen. And, you know, even with people that she's intimately involved with, the activists, you know, and they do some intense things, right? Like she's chained herself to trees. She's chained herself to a former California senator's desk. You know, like she, and so she's willing to do these pretty radical things. She's a pretty radical activist. And the group Heartwood isn't as radical as this kind of depicts them to sound. They're typically about, you know, getting together resources from one area of the country and getting them to another part where they need, right? So in this case, firewood, because, you know, the police barricade around Standing Rock was intended to, you know, kind of, this might sound extreme, but sort of like a Warsaw ghetto type of starving out, you know, like denying resources, and then maybe they'll just willingly leave. Mm-hmm. You know, as it turns out, they underestimated that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But just that, you know, the idea that she doesn't have control, she's not driving this truck, right? She doesn't have that gun. But she's in this situation, as she calls it, right? And but also the idea of what she's most fearful about is the fact that she even has to do this. It's not about doing it. It terrifies her that this is even a circumstance that she needs to enter, which I think is really poignant and brave.
Yeah, I appreciate thinking about courage and bravery as a willingness to show up and to be present and to act in the face of uncertainty, unpredictability, and with risks that are involved with that. And I think that translates beyond the concept and experience of collective protest. I think in general, I would want for my students, for my loved ones to have an increased capacity to be present in the midst of discomfort and in the midst of uncertainty in this world, because across our lifetimes, there are moments that seem more predictable, and there are moments of heightened precarity and uncertainty, and we're all called to face that and to act in the midst of that.
Yeah, and you know, kind of thinking about it in that way, it makes me think about like, who are our heroes, right? Mm-hmm. Who are our cultural heroes? You know, we think of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, right? A lot of civil rights heroes, but also, you know, our founding fathers and the idea that they stood up to England, you know, and fought for our freedom. Just kind of looking at this across time, it just it feels uncomfortable and bizarre actually to me to now, you know, try to cast these people that are exercising their First Amendment rights in the same way that our heroes have in the past, and making them look suspicious, right? Like, because, you know, protest is for all kinds of reasons, but one prominent one is for other people to see that these people care about your lives, that these people care about your well-being, that you're not alone, you know. And one of my participants talked about in my dissertation talked about that he was happy to just be a dot on an aerial plane, you know, that he knows that he went there, he filled in that, and that people can see that he's there, you know. And he's in his 70s, and he talked about protesting during Vietnam and going to a big gathering at the University of Delaware, and kind of being in this crowd where people are shouting around like, hey, if anyone's getting drafted or is in danger of getting drafted, there's a guy over here that can get you papers to get to Canada and get out of the country. And he was just sitting there kind of thinking like, I'm not even doing enough. You know, like, I feel like I did so much getting here, but now that I'm here, I'm realizing there's a lot more that can be done, and there are people doing so much more. And that gave him some comfort, and also kind of inspired him to become more dedicated, because, you know, he actually lost his best friend from high school to he was harvested in the war, as he put it, and really front of mind for him. And also his privilege that he was a college student, and so he didn't have to worry about that. But that, you know, that's because his, you know, my grandparents were able to support their children to go to college. But, you know, he's kind of reflected on, if I didn't have that, I would be in the same amount of risk, you know, and terror that other people are, in that they don't want to go kill people, and they don't want to die for something that they don't understand or believe in.
I also want to commend you, Shelley, for your courageous witnessing of the stories of protesters that you're able to show up and create and hold space for them to narrate their life worlds. That's an act of courage on your part.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it. You know, I learn everything, you know, through other people. I'm not in a vacuum. You know, as you, of course, understand as well. And it was such an enriching project to hear about all these different types of protest events. You know, and this whole kind of stratum of danger, you know, and also, you know, this idea that you can do this a number of different ways, and it doesn't, I'm not trying to like scare people off. There are a number of ways and nicely organized sorts of events that you can go to. You know, like, so I interviewed another participant who was very involved in Occupy Ferguson after Mike Brown's murder, kind of like that sparked Black Lives Matter protests. And, you know, and he was sleeping like on the street. He was compromising. He was in graduate school at the time for getting a PhD in philosophy, but he was just like, this is more philosophical and more important and more ontological than anywhere else I could be. And so he actually ended up leaving school, throwing himself fully into the Occupy movement. And, you know, and then, I mean, so he does, you know, that more like radical, dangerous bend. And as a matter of fact, he also discussed being a member of Black Bloc, which is Antifa's arm that does want destruction, right? Like, they wear all black masks. And he talked about that, you know, that it's important for the Black Bloc to be identifiable, right, as separate from everyone else, but to also do that really, kind of destructive work. And he said that there's something very intimate and loving about destroying things with other people wearing masks, which I found pretty hard to wrap my head around. But he also talked about, you know, you can march in a protest on a Saturday, you know, and they can try to like shut it down, and you can be like, all right, I'll leave. Or he's like, it's pretty powerful to have like 20 people just lay down in the street, and it's hard to move someone. It's hard to move a body. And he's like, you know, you can arrest us if you want, but we're going to make it really, really hard on you. And it's going to look weird for other people that are watching.
So in listening to you, in the story that you just shared, that act of what might be self-described as loving destruction not only happens in and through our bodies, it is very much emplaced, right? It happens in places. And going back to Catherine, right, she is carrying firewood to a prairie in the winter, and that wood is necessary in that place to heat and to cook. And it's the middle of the night, right? It's in the woods, or you're laying on a street and that's going to demand this uncomfortable, you're going to move me from this place. Let's talk for just a bit about the emplaced nature of protesting.
Sure. So the first thing that comes to mind is my experience. The biggest protest that's ever happened, and the biggest protest I've attended was the Women's March, and we were kind of towards the front of this march. You know, it was absolutely packed, right? But it was very peaceful and respectful, and I thought that was great. I mean, there was a lot of anger. There was a lot of wonderful signs. There was a lot of purpose. But we were kind of towards the front of the march, and we kind of realized that we have now reached the end of it. And there's like no, you know, you're just walking, we're spilling into the road and there's cars. There wasn't really like a, and then you'll go here, right? So just everyone just starts kind of spilling into the roads, you know, cars just are like, oh, okay, I guess I'm going to pull over here. You know, and there were cars that were like honking, like, stop it, you know, good luck, buddy, right? here comes 2 million or 3 million people. Yeah, love it. Love your horn. But a lot of people were encouraging, you know, and like got out of their cars and sort of joined. And it sort of just meandered and wandered wherever it went. And it was pretty interesting to me. And it's definitely, you know, the way that I sort of think about protests and this framework, this existential framework that I came up with in my dissertation, focused on what I called existential universals, which is, there's six of them. So time, space, self, other, embodiment, and then choice and freedom kind of together. And so it's always kind of all of those all at once, right? Mm-hmm, like it's mm-hmm. me, it's my body, it's relational to others, it's in a place, it's at a time, and you know, and it's a choice that's being made. And you know, none of those are neutral, right? That all of those are imbued with complexities, you know, and the visibility, you know, of onlookers. So another article I wrote is about I'm sure you do remember these people, but during COVID there was kind of this just atrocious scene that was all over the news of a Black Lives Matter protesting group called Expect Us in St. Louis that were going to the St. Louis mayor's office to address the fact that her name was Lyda Crewson, the fact that she used a COVID sort of safety information Facebook live session to start doxing her own citizens that had written her letters requesting that they defund the police, right? It's a radical notion. You start bigger than you want, and then you compromise to something. But so the fact that she had kind of said, oh, you know, and here's Shelley who lives over on, you know, North End Road, and she wants no money. And so they're like, well, let's just come to your house then. And they wanted to paint resign on the road in front of her house. Earlier in the day, police had closed off Kings Highway, which is the main thoroughfare in the east end of St. Louis. So they actually were blocked from a public road by a police barricade. So they just so happened to realize that there's a corner gate in a private neighborhood. These are very common in St. Louis. And St. Louis is incidentally one of the first places to design private property and private neighborhoods and private roads. That's a whole other thing, but you know, making them too curvy, so it's not helpful, paying for their own construction, whatever. So So they're blocked from the public road, and they realize that this gate in Portland Place, which is a real fancy development, is unlocked. And so they walk through it, and they're just heading through. They're two blocks away to Lida Crewson's, the mayor's house. And all of a sudden, out of this really intense mansion comes Mark and Patricia McCloskey, two very wealthy injury lawyers, malpractice lawyers. One of them's holding a AK-47, which is Mark. The other one's holding like a little silver pistol, and they're pointing it at the protesters, screaming for them to get the hell out of their neighborhood. And like, it's private property, get out. And the protesters are shocked. But you know, what's also crazy here is the way that they're handling their weapons. They're like pointing it at each other, you know, like they're just so hysterical. They're not operating it, you know, correctly. So this brings up some very important, if we're talking about place and space, legal ramifications, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If they believe that this is private property and that they can hold their guns at people, right, to get them away, then I guess that would be okay. But what happens to these peaceful protesters? And if the public road is denied to them, you know, what? So like, it's just this fascinating sort of paradox for mm-hmm, me mm-hmm, of, mm-hmm. you know, so what ended up happening was that they got in trouble for menacing, right? I mean, you can protect your property, but you can't menace people that are just like walking by. It was pretty complicated. But, you know, kind of the takeaway for me was that we have to preserve this healthy public spaces, you know, for protests to be able to happen. This is our First Amendment, right? At first, extremely important one. But then the second one with, you know, and the first one is a public collective amendment, right? And the second one really is all about individualism, right? And property ownership and private property is something that was very core to the foundation of our democracy in our country, because in England, everything's owned by, you know, the crown or like lords. There's no private property in England. I don't know if you know that, but no one owns any property. So that means a couple things. It means like if you buy a house, you pay rent to like the lord that owns that property, but not the house. Mm. So like someone can own the house, but not the property, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Another interesting thing about that, because my brother's girlfriend is from London and he lives there now. Another thing is, since there is no private property, you can go out in the country and walk through anyone's property. No one owns that property. You know, well, actually, I mean, the lords, right, own that. And then the people that live there pay rent. But the people that live there, it's not their property. So, like, you can camp anywhere you want in the country as long as you're... The rule of thumb is sort of stay out of the view of the house, you know, the house owners. You don't want to set up camp, like, right outside their balcony. But there is no private property. So, you know, I kind of learned about that. But, you know, in thinking about territory. And so we kind of have this obsession in the U.S. with private property, with privacy. And, you know, it's very much connected to guns and this impetus, like this revolutionary patriot, whatever you want to call it, sort of mentality of I need to protect my property from people. And, you know, the subtext of that is they want to destroy or take your property when no, you know, like there's this paranoia that doesn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, that was kind of long winded, but just in thinking about space, like we have to have spaces, and this is getting more, you know, it's getting more threatened by states that are trying to make protest or, you know, protest events have permits. And that means that you have to ask if you can come protest. And that's not the First Amendment. The First Amendment is you can. You go in public and you do it. And then I guess part of this too is this idea actually was hanging out with one of my friends. I went with a group of friends to Vegas and met like a new, you know, a friend of a friend. And they were talking about how like when we were walking along Vegas and people were just kind of jaywalking here and there, he's just like, this is like a protest when everyone just wants to block the path to the hospital. And I'm like, okay. You know, we had a long talk after that. It was good. It was helpful. But but there is this idea that is a stereotype about protesting, that they are there to do something to you or to prevent people from being able to do stuff when it's, you know, it's not tit for tat. It's typically responding to institutional policies, and we rely on people to do this sort of thing. This is revolutionary work to me.
And that revolutionary work, that anxious business that is carried out in our bodies alongside other body cells and in places through the choices that we make, that also assumes a certain amount of emotional and physical energy and risk. So as we wrap up our conversation, Shelley, I'd like to talk about a question that you pose in the article that I think is of particular relevance to listeners of Defining Moments and readers of Health Communication. And that's, how do we manage the competing tensions between the security of our everyday existence and our concern for others who may be suffering? How do we manage, right?
Yeah.
The competing tensions between the security of our everyday existence and our concern for others who may be suffering. What that means for well-being.
Sure. Maybe this is, you know, extreme, but I'm a big fan of Hannah Arendt's work, like a brilliant political philosopher. And she talked about, she wrote an important book about the banality of evil. Actually, I also have The Origins of Totalitarianism next to me here, and yeah. Men in Dark Times. But one of her you know, concerns and something that she writes about that I think is really complicated is, you know, she's a Jew. She had to leave Germany during World War II, and she was critical of Jews that once they sort of realized that that things were happening to other Jewish people, she's a little critical that they didn't immediately think then that this can happen to me, that there was sort of this, you know, and there's no criticism of any of these people, but this is sort of her position is how can we feel like that we're different or we're special when we are seeing this happen to people just like us, that, yeah. And so, you know, that's a complex critique. You know, the other thing she looked at is how easy it is to go along with evil, the banality of evil, right? Like during the Nuremberg trials, the Nazi officer that was in charge of sending all of the various Jews from across Europe to the concentration camps, like just, and when he was on trial, she attended the trial and she's like, this is just a regular guy. You know, he's like, why did I do it? He's like, I didn't really do anything. I liked my job. I wanted to impress my bosses. I was good at it. You know, he's like, I didn't have any problem with any of these people. And so for her, that was just so incredible to wrap her mind around that, you know, you today you're going to send 200,000 people to the gas chamber and you don't feel responsible for that because it's not, you know, you don't know them or like you like your job. So, you know, so what she talks about is she talks about like these three areas of life, which is work, labor, and life activa. So work for her is the biological existence, the sustenance of our bodies, that we need food, water, friendships, people, safety, you know, and freedom. And then labor for her is, you know, contributing to an economy, right? Producing human-made objects and having services for other people, you know, making a living. But she says that these two first ones are increasingly occupying people's entire lives and that they're missing this third part, which, you know, kind of comes from Aristotle, the idea of life activa. And this is, for her, the importance of having a public presence with others, of engaging with other people in public, that we need more spaces for this interchange to happen, you know, right? Where strangers don't feel so strange to each other, right? Maybe this, you know, the McCloskeys, for some, you know, for example, were to engage with, go to a rap concert or something, right? Maybe you wouldn't be so afraid of these people of color, you know, that are just responding to something that was said about them. And, you know, so why is it important, and what does it have to do with our health and well-being? You know, I can't imagine a life where you don't care about other people. That can't be any kind of life.
Right.
And it's, you know, it feels like that people are getting more afraid or more anxious, you know, of going in public. I don't know if it's our gun culture. I don't know if it's our politics. You know, I don't know It's all different kinds of things, the wage disparity, you know, the have and have nots. But I think it's more important than ever for people to involve themselves in public activities with others, you know, and that it is a very ethical and worthy exercise to care about other people. And if you don't care about other people, then I don't know what kind of life, you know, you're living. Because for me, that is the purpose of life, is to support and love other people. And, you know, if we have an opportunity to do something that could help other people, then that's the type of thing that I'd like to do. You know, I have restrictions on myself, right? Like, I'm not going to commit violence, you know, in the interest of other people. But just even being there, you know, sometimes is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen. I think we have this modern view of self-care that it's done in isolation.
Yeah.
And it's mainly about your personal well-being. And I don't want to discredit that. I get it. Anybody who knows me well knows that I love a bath at the end of the evening surrounded by candles.
Yes.
And a more radical perspective that you're speaking to is one that includes both personal well-being and improved community well-being, and one that goes beyond an individualistic response to crisis and to burnout, and that really care for the soul is asking what is lacking in our everyday practices that make care for self and others so imperative. And maybe that's a fast-paced, unrelenting demands of work that we live in.
And that makes me think about this one other thing too. So Kierkegaard, you know, absurdist, phenomenologist, existentialist, really fascinating person. But he talked about how it's important to go out and take people baths, just like you like a bath. But, you know, he had a lazy eye. He also walked with a cane and had like a club foot. So when he would go out, he knew he would be stared at. He knew he would be humiliated and othered, but he knew that was an important part of his life because he was fairly reclusive, but also said it's important to take regular people baths and go out there. And he was surprised sometimes when people didn't stare at him or when people talked with him, you know, and it like kept him sane in this way. And so I think, you know, that kind of speaks to it. And I feel like we can all kind of feel this feeling of like, you know, maybe there's a party or something and you're like, man, I really don't want to go. Or maybe the gym, right? Maybe the gym's easier to imagine here. Like, I know I should go. I really don't want to go. And then you don't go. And the whole time that you were supposed to be there, you're just thinking about how you're not there. Like, that's not very healthy, you know, like just more adventure, more contact, more embracing how strong we are, you know, and how able we are to go out. And you know, I think that the idea of like, what's the worst that could happen deters people sometimes. And the news, right, coverage of sort of protests trying to make them look dangerous is working against that. But yeah, I'm inspired to see the protests that are happening right now with the strong chilling function, you know, functions that are being run against that really precious right that we need to preserve and exercise.
Again, amen to that. Thank you, Shelley, and thanks to all of our listeners for joining us today on this episode of the Defining Moments podcast. Defining Moments is produced by WOUB Public Media and the Barbara Gerald Institute for Storytelling and Social Impact. The Storytelling Institute imagines a world where storytelling creates just and joyful communities. Joe Bianco and I are co-producers, and Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. You can subscribe to Defining Moments at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the NPR Podcast Directory. We hope you'll follow us on Facebook and Instagram at DMPodcastWOUB. On our show notes and on social media, we'll provide links to Shelley's recently published article in Health Communication that has served as an anchor for our conversation today. Thank you, everybody, and be well.